Blog Talk Radio.
This is the news in brief from the United Nations. Nearly half of women surveyed in 57 developing countries do not have the right to say no to sex, use contraception or seek health care, the UN Population Fund, UNFPA, said on Wednesday. In a new report, it suggests that this lack of choice causes profound harm to women and girls, leaving most of them powerless. More widely, UNFPA warned that the fact that millions of women and girls do not own their own bodies likely affects economic productivity, undercutting skills and resulting in higher healthcare costs. Here's the agency's Geneva director, Monica Ferro.
A woman who has control over her body is more likely to be empowered in other spheres of her life. She gains not only in terms of autonomy, but also through advances in health and education, income and safety. She is more likely to thrive, and so is her family. When we see these benefits accrue across whole societies, we understand that communities and countries will flourish when all people are empowered to make their own informed choices about their bodies and their futures.
UNFPA's 2021 State of World Population report shows that only 55% of women are fully empowered to make choices over healthcare, contraception, and whether to say yes or no to sex. The report also found that 20 countries allow rapists to escape prosecution if they marry their victim, and 43 have no legislation to address marital rape. More than 30 countries still restrict women's right to leave their home, while girls and boys with disabilities are nearly three times more likely to be subjected to sexual violence, with girls at the greatest risk. Now to a UN-partnered bid to bring countries together to tackle diabetes, the only major non-communicable disease where the risk of dying early is going up rather than down, according to the World Health Organization, WHO. Announcing the move on Wednesday at the Global Diabetes Summit, WHO Director General Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus warned that the number of people with diabetes has quadrupled in the last 40 years. A high proportion of those who are severely ill in hospital with COVID-19 have diabetes, Tedros said, before expressing hope that the Global Diabetes Compact would catalyze political commitment for action to increase the accessibility and affordability of life-saving medicines for diabetes. 100 years since insulin was discovered, the hormone which controls blood sugar levels and which those with the illness do not have, WHO said that far greater access is needed to it in low and middle income countries, along with other diabetes diagnostic tools. About half of all adults with type 2 diabetes today remain undiagnosed. 50% of those with this type of disease do not get the insulin they need, which places them at risk of premature death, limb amputations, and sight loss. Innovative and cheap diagnostic solutions for diabetes will be one of the core components of the new Global Compact, WHO explained, and there will also be internationally agreed targets and advocacy to push for help for diabetes patients as part of countries' universal healthcare commitments. Violence attributed to Israeli settlers against Palestinians in the West Bank has risen in recent months amidst an atmosphere of impunity, UN-appointed independent rights experts said on Wednesday, highlighting more than 210 incidents already this year and one Palestinian fatality. The special rapporteurs urged the Israeli authorities to investigate thoroughly. In southern Hebron on the 13th of March, they described how a Palestinian family was attacked by 10 Israeli settlers, some of them armed. The injured parents were treated at a medical facility and their 8 children were left traumatized, said Michael Link, special rapporteur on the situation of human rights in the Palestinian territory occupied since 1967. In a joint statement, Mr. Link said that settler violence was ideologically motivated and primarily designed to take over land, but also to intimidate and terrorize Palestinians. Pregnant women, young children and older people were not off limits, the rights experts said, particularly in rural areas where livestock, agricultural lands, trees and homes were targeted. Together with the expansion of Israeli settlements, the settler violence was intended to make the daily lives of Palestinians untenable, the experts maintained. The independent experts who report to the Human Rights Council also noted how the Israeli military were present in many cases but had failed to protect the Palestinians. Daniel Johnson, UN News.
This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we learn about a new development, namely vaccination passports. New York has already started implementing them, but what are the problems?
Well, not only do we have the very likely possibility of this pandemic not going away, but now we have a problem of it being compounded by kind of a police state method of checking out everybody. Listen to what the ACLU leader in Connecticut has to say about that problem.
We touch base with Flint Taylor of the People's Law Office in Chicago as the Derek Chauvin case verdict approaches.
Everybody that sees this video wants to throw the book at this guy, but there are broader questions involved here. What kind of society do we have that does this, and what can we do about that?
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian. New York State recently became the first in the country to premiere a COVID-19 vaccine passport. It's called the Excelsior Pass, and proponents claim it's a safe and efficient way for people to return to sporting events, concerts, Broadway theaters, and other large group settings. You show a QR code proving a recent negative test or a full vaccination. The pass is currently voluntary and lets New Yorkers upload their official results from a number of different vaccination sites and laboratories into the system to verify that the person holding the pass meets the standards for entry. The state first used it at a Buffalo Bills football game in January, after which they monitored attendees for 14 days and discovered, quote, almost negligible transmission. Registration in the program requires three pieces of information, name, date of birth, and zip code. The pass is matched to vaccination and testing records using a series of questions to prevent fraud. When the person arrives at a venue, they show a photo ID with their code, which generates a green check mark. New York State officials say they've been in close talks with surrounding states about integrating systems, but neighboring states claim it's not a priority. Connecticut, for example, says it doesn't have immediate plans to roll out a vaccine passport, although Governor Ned Lamont has said it's possible to see private sector solutions if demand grows and if the technology is proven effective. Joining us today is attorney David McGuire. He's executive director of the ACLU of Connecticut and is also the chair of the Connecticut Special Advisory Committee to the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights. He serves on the state's Racial Profiling Prohibition Project Advisory Board and is a member of the Commission on Racial and Ethnic Disparities in the Criminal Justice System. David, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thanks for having me.
David, what are vaccine passports?
Well, the idea of vaccine passports is some type of a credential that would be required to gain access to a myriad of life-affirming services. You know, we really don't know a lot about what particular administrators are thinking about. We know that our governor here in Connecticut has floated the idea. He seems to have backed off it after opposition, but he was thinking of it as a way to help open government and business quickly, and we have real concerns about it.
Recently, the Washington Post reported that the Biden administration was working with corporations to create a mechanism for such passports. There seem to be many civil liberties downsides, not only with the passports, but also with the idea of partnering with corporations. Can you discuss some of the main concerns that the ACLU and you have?
Sure. I mean, we want to create a safe environment as much as anyone else, and we know that it is tempting for the government to look for quick fixes to restart the economy and to get back to normal. But you can't do so at the cost of civil rights and civil liberties. So we have real issues here in Connecticut. We are looking at a situation where the rollout of vaccines in our state has been deeply problematic from a racial equity perspective. There's a large gap between white folks and black and brown folks in terms of vaccines, and we worry on an equity issue if the government is to require some kind of a vaccine passport, that it would naturally disadvantage people that have not had access to the vaccine and prevent them from engaging in everything they need to on a day-to-day basis. There are also very real privacy concerns that we have around the potential of a government vaccine passport. We know that the government has had many issues in the past with data integrity, with using databases for other intended reasons down the road, the idea of mission creep. And we're very concerned that the idea of a vaccine passport and the privacy implications might actually backfire and result in some people not getting vaccinated because they don't want to be part of such a digital system.
Attorney David McGuire, what do proponents say is wrong with the existing documentation of vaccinations? Why cannot it be accessed for certain limited purposes, such as medical jobs or overseas travel?
Well, I mean, I think that in some cases, and I really can only speak to Connecticut with any fidelity, but it's kind of a solution in search of a problem. Right now, people are getting, when they do get vaccinated, a card or a printed out record like I got when I got vaccinated from your medical provider showing that you in fact got the vaccine. There may be some legitimate reasons why certain employers would require proof of vaccine or something of that nature, but there's not been, in my mind or in things I've read, a demonstrated need for a either state or federal vaccine passport, particularly a digital one, which is what we are most concerned about. We're concerned about a centralized digital vaccine passport system that might well stretch way beyond the COVID pandemic and, you know, could be something that creates a new normal, which is, in our mind, not necessary.
That raises an issue of who gets access to the database. Law enforcement, for example, even if initially, as you said, with mission creep, only one entity has access, couldn't it then go on to be shared with others?
That's a very real concern. We worry that the creation of a new database will potentially lead to misuse or overuse. You know, we've seen this in other areas. We've seen, for example, police get access to different databases and use them for over-policing certain communities. There need to be very, very strong airtight privacy protections to create public confidence. And even with that, you know, there's always a concern that this will live on in a way that will be problematic for people. So I think for many reasons, government should be focusing on getting as many people vaccinated and creating herd immunity rather than trying to impose some type of dystopian vaccine passport.
I don't think we've ever had vaccine passports before, say for measles or any other health issue.
I think that's a great point that you make. I mean, we have other serious illnesses like measles where, you know, we have successfully achieved herd immunity. Yes, there are occasionally flare-ups of it, but ultimately there's not been a need or a documented need for there to be a universal passport for those vaccinations. Similarly here, you know, we're not opposed to vaccine passports 100%. There can be ways to do it that, you know, could be useful and not impinge on people's civil rights and civil liberties, but the way that it's been talked about, at least here in Connecticut, would be really broad and hastily done, and again, there doesn't seem to be a need for it, so we're quite concerned about it.
David, how would these passports be generated? Talk about the good way to do it.
Well, I mean, the way to do it that would be least harmful is in a decentralized, open-source way, in a way that's not trackable and in a way that allows folks to show the credential in a way that is not them selling their privacy, essentially. The other thing that's very important is that there be a paper-based alternative. We know that there are many older people, low-income people, and people with disabilities that do not have access to a smartphone. And this is, if we were to go to a digital passport, that you need to go to certain public accommodations, for example, you'd have to make it such that it is easy and readily available to everyone. So there are ways to do it. It will take quite a bit of thought and time and partnership to get there. The conversation that was started a couple of weeks ago by our governor here in Connecticut was one that, you know, kind of just popped out of nowhere and didn't seem like a fully baked idea. That's what we really worry about, government running with something to solve, again, a problem that we don't see as a legitimate one right now.
David, just to clarify for our listeners, what is an open source database?
Well, the idea is that there should not just be one entity that is allowed to keep and create the database that everyone has to use in order to get your vaccine passport. And the reality is that we think it should be done in a way that takes advantage of technologies that we have to create a credentialing system that allows people to control their own credentials and their identity in something of a digital wallet. You've probably heard a lot around that around cryptocurrency, but there are lots of technologies that can be done in a way that doesn't create a massive trove of sensitive medical data that is tied to people. That's what we're concerned about. We're concerned about a database with hundreds of millions of entries that could be misused or corrupted or sold. I mean, there's lots of scenarios you can think of that would be problematic. A decentralized open source system would safeguard against a lot of those concerns.
David, New York State became the first in the nation to premiere a vaccine passport, and I understand they contacted neighboring states. Do you know if our governor reached out to Ted Lamont?
I don't know that. I mean, I do know that the governors in the tri-state area have worked together throughout the pandemic. I'm not sure whether they reached out to the Lamont administration, but the reality is, you know, these are issues that need to be taken seriously by local and state government. It was refreshing to see the Biden administration just yesterday mention that they are really hesitant to get involved in a federal passport and don't see the role for the federal government in such a system. They're kind of kicking the can down to the state level. And at least here in Connecticut, when the governor raised the idea of a vaccine passport, there was pushback from, for example, the Restaurant Association, our organization, and also some concerned citizens who are not looking forward to another government database with health information in it.
Just to clarify a little terminology, what's the difference between a standardized system for presenting proof of vaccine and a digital system for doing so?
Well, I mean, the idea is that there would be a passport that people could rely on, that they would know is authenticated and real. Right now, you know, people are getting either a printout from their medical provider or a card that, at least in Connecticut, is a standardized CDC card that says you've gotten your first or your second vaccine. You know, that is something that makes sense, but there's ways to do that in ways that don't undermine privacy. A digital system is just that, one that is a digital, exclusively digital system, which I think there is some allure or government thinks that going digital is the future. You know, they're trying to make things more available and accessible and easier to access through a digital system. But as I mentioned before, there are lots of people that are not able to access such a system. There are real gaps in technology access and ability to access technology that make a fully digital system deeply problematic because you would leave people behind.
So if the government determines it must design a system, what
three factors do you recommend,
like not only digital, decentralized and open sourced, and doesn't allow for tracking or creation of a new database? Are those important?
Those are the three most critical. So you really read my mind or have my talking points, because those are the pieces that you would have to have at a bare minimum to make a system workable and mitigate against the downside. The other thing that's important that is not explicitly in those three are really well thought out privacy safeguards from the start that prevent the expansion or the expanded use of such data. You know, we know that whenever the government says, "Oh, let's get this going, we'll figure out the privacy protections afterwards," it never quite works out the right way. It's important to get this right from the start.
David, you mentioned problems when individuals can't obtain vaccines, but what about individuals who choose not to get the vaccine? What are the repercussions if we see such a system implemented for people like that?
You raise a great question, Heidi. There's two different categories of folks that a system has to think about before it's launched. One is people that are not medically able to get vaccinated. There are some people that have contraindications and are not able to be vaccinated for medical reasons. Those people need to be able to, you know, in such a system of verification, show that they can in fact get it. But there's another category of people that you mentioned who, for you know, many reasons don't want to be vaccinated. It is important that folks be able to still get access to public services and public accommodations. So there need to be some real thinking on the part of the government of how to create a system that does not essentially freeze people out from society. But as I think you mentioned earlier in your question, our real big concern is that there's a huge gap in swath of people here in Connecticut and across the country who have not been able to obtain a vaccine, who want to and need to continue living. You know, obviously they should be complying with public health mandates of mask wearing and social distancing. But if you go to a system where now you need a vaccine passport to show you're vaccinated to get access to certain services, you're going to freeze out a lot of people, and that's a big, big problem.
Is there a danger that this thing will be overused and even become mandatory?
I think there is a real concern around that. The reality is that we're still in a global pandemic. People are rightfully concerned about their public health, and people are trying to get vaccinated. But there will come a time, hopefully, you know, sooner than later, where this pandemic is under control and we're back to more of what you consider a normal situation. And what we're concerned about is that such a system is launched and then continues on and takes on other attributes or other requirements. So, you know, we've seen this in several other instances where there are emergencies. I mean, think back to 9/11 and all the privacy safeguards that were eroded and never came back. You know, that's something that we take very seriously.
You know, that reminds me, David, in 1905, the Supreme Court ruled that states could require residents to be vaccinated against smallpox or have to pay a fine. So I don't think we're facing a similar situation because of the problems we've seen with rollout of the vaccines, but it shows how the high court has ruled in certain similar cases.
Public health officials have been nearly unanimous in saying that the most important thing to do right now is to get information to folks, to let them know as much as they can about the virus and the vaccine so that people are educated about it and can make an informed decision. And we've seen that when people are given the information that they're overwhelmingly wanting to become vaccinated. And, you know, we know that the goal ultimately is to get up to herd immunity. You know, there's, again, I sound like a broken record, but it is very important that the government spend their time and resources on ensuring as many people can get vaccinated quickly and safely rather than on something like a vaccine passport at this point.
You know, we have the federal Real ID taking effect in October 2021. And as you've alluded to, we have multiple ways of tracking individuals with very personal information. I understand that airlines have created or partnered with a range of health passport apps. In addition to airport security check companies, Clear's Health Pass. Can you talk about that briefly?
So I don't know that much about it, but what I do know is that, you know, private entities have more leeway than government in determining, you know, how they operate and how they come back. There are clearly some, you know, some dangers to, you know, just the idea of a passport running exclusively in the private field and then the government partnering with those private sector industries and essentially sidestepping the public process. That is something that is concerning. So we're monitoring all of that carefully and closely. The reality is that there's going to be a balance that corporations strike because they unlike government in a lot of ways, are much more immediately impacted by whether consumers like or don't like something. You know, in a lot of ways, if the corporate world goes too far, the consumers will stop using that service or that provider. So there's a natural check there, but we are monitoring, at least here in Connecticut, all of these interactions between government and corporations as they start to deal with the post-pandemic world.
We've been talking to attorney David McGuire, the executive director of the ACLU of Connecticut. David, what's the ACLU in Connecticut doing in terms of public education on the vaccine passports?
Well, and we're trying to give people all the information that they need to understand how to interface with their government entities around it. Here in Connecticut, we've done some public education to let folks know about some of the risks. And if there is a public push for a vaccine passport here in Connecticut, we want people to be able to meaningfully engage with their government elected officials, whether it be their state senator or rep or the governor, to let them know whether their concerns are what they are, and to figure out whether they're themselves okay with it or not. And that is really a situation where people vary based on their comfort with government. But, you know, a lot of the people I talk to are really distrustful of the government when it comes to maintaining databases and things of this nature. And they should be able to raise those concerns if they have them.
The White House coronavirus coordinator has gone on record saying, quote, any solutions in this area should be simple, free, open source, accessible to people both digitally and on paper, and designed from the start to protect people's privacy. Does that give you hope?
It does. I mean, that checks a lot of the boxes of what we're looking for in any potential system dealing with the coronavirus. And, you know, I think that the White House and the task force are hearing a loud mandate from people across the country that they don't want to trade their civil rights and civil liberties away. And the last few days, what we've heard from the White House is definitely welcomed.
David, how can our listeners learn more about your work and the work of the ACLU of Connecticut?
Well, they can go to aclucity.org, which is our website. Also, if they're listening from other states, their state has an affiliate ACLU that they can find online. And our national organization is aclu.org. They have some great privacy resources on that website as well.
David, before we let you go, are there any final comments that you wanted to make that we may not have touched on about this?
No, I just think it's important that your listeners read the news carefully and monitor their in particular state and local governments as this idea proliferates, and really urge their elected officials to focus on getting as many people educated as possible.
Well, David McGuire, it's been a true pleasure to talk to you today, and keep up the great work.
And stay healthy.
Yeah, yes, you too. Thank you so much.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org. for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
Sadistic police murder of George Floyd last June on a Minneapolis sidewalk was videoed by a courageous 17-year-old bystander. Her video was viewed by Americans around the country and people around the world. It captured Minneapolis police officer Derek Chauvin smirking with one hand in his pocket as he knelt for 9 minutes and 29 seconds on George Floyd's neck. Floyd was handcuffed behind his back and restrained by two other police officers at the time. He begged for his life, called for his mother, and repeatedly said, "I cannot breathe." Onlookers gathered in protest as the murder progressed, but their intercession was of no avail. George Floyd's life drained out of him. He lost his pulse. Still, Chauvin persisted, kneeling on the dead man. An ambulance came to take away George Floyd's corpse. People's response was massive and sustained. In some 2,000 cities across America, 20 million people, black and white, black-led, protested in the streets. More than demanding that George Floyd's killer be brought to justice, they demanded that police departments be defunded, that police be controlled by the community, and that ending police murders of black people be brought to a halt once and for all. We are now in the midst of the trial of the killer cop, Derek Chauvin. Millions of Americans are watching the trial. It seems to them that this latest racist police outrage is the culmination of so many past murders. They are asking, what is to be done? We speak today with attorney Flint Taylor. He's a founding partner of the People's Law Office in Chicago. Starting over 50 years ago, Taylor and his office represented the family of the Black Panther leader Fred Hampton, who was assassinated by the Chicago Police Department with the help of the FBI. Taylor has represented numerous police abuse and torture survivors and is one of the lawyers involved in the struggle for reparations. He has chronicled the decade-long fight against Chicago police torture and wrote the award-winning book, The Torture Machine, Racism and Violence in Chicago. Taylor is the founding editor of the Police Misconduct and Civil Rights Law Reporter.
Flint Taylor, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Thank you, Heidi. Thank you, Michael.
Flint, we know that Derek Chauvin's attorney is defending him on the basis that Chauvin was just following police procedure, that was the way he was trained, and that besides, George Floyd died because of a bad heart and the ingestion of drugs. What do you think of that defense?
Well, I think as defense lawyers, you need to put in also, of course, the racial aspects of it and making George Floyd into, you know, this superhuman black man that jurors and people should be afraid of and that police officers are supposed to fear and save the white public from. That's obviously an undercurrent of the entire defense and cross-examinations and all of that. But that's a defense that we see in these kinds of cases all the time. My office and I are involved in a very similar case in North Carolina where an African-American man was hogtied by 8 white police officers, and 3 minutes later he was dead. The defense that we're fighting against is the same one. He didn't die from the restraint. He died because he had a bad heart and he had drugs in his system. He was having a mental crisis. All of those kinds of things are what they're raising in North Carolina. The difference in the two cases is it's so outrageous on the videotape in Minneapolis. The police superintendent or chief of police has had to cut Chauvin loose. And whereas in North Carolina, we've done depositions of everyone from the mayor to the former chief to the current chief to all of the cops to the city manager, and each one of them embraces the hog tying, which has been banned across the South and in most jurisdictions, but not in Greensboro. And they've all come to say it was pursuant to policy. There's nothing wrong with what these men did, and are paying hundreds and hundreds of thousands of dollars to defend the case. So that's the more likely scenario in these kinds of cases where a person of color dies at the hand of police with some kind of non-lethal or sometimes lethal, when I use that term, deadly force, but, you know, with a weapon. They die that way, and the defense looks for alternative reasons in order to escape criminal liability or civil liability.
Flint Taylor, let's talk about the jury. They're all not all white. What might that do to affect the outcome?
Well, juries are obviously very important in cases, and particularly political cases, cases where police officers or law enforcement officials are defendants, because they obviously have a major leg up with juries as they do with judges in this system of this legal system. The fact that there are
I believe, 4 African-American jurors and 2 other jurors of color, makes it more likely, particularly given the video in this case, that there will be a verdict that will be against the police officer, if not on the highest charge, the most serious charge of murder, perhaps a compromise verdict on one of the lesser charges. We saw a criminal trial here in Chicago, the Laquan McDonald murder, and in that case, there was a conviction. That was the 16 shots case, an outrageous, outrageous case. So I think there is a real possibility for a jury verdict in the Chauvin case.
When we spoke last week with attorney Michael Tygar about this case, he told us he thought the most effective prosecutorial tactic would have been for the prosecutor to admit that he was a racist or that America is a racist society and everyone living here is a racist, and also that the jury should look into their own hearts about their own racism. What are your thoughts about that?
Well, I would never contradict an icon like Mike Tygar. I obviously have a tremendous amount of respect for what Michael would say. The racism prosecution approach. We've taken that as an aspect of cases where we have been representing plaintiffs in civil cases. In the Fred Hampton case, we obviously did not shy away from the racism that was involved in the murders, and the racism that was involved in the way that the Panthers were being depicted. And in the police torture cases, we had to come to face to face with the racism as well, of the torture of black man charged and convicted of killing 2 white cops, tortured by a very highly decorated white police commander. So you can't walk away from racism, but I hesitate to embrace completely a prosecution that was premised only on the racism that is not only inherent but obvious in the Minnesota prosecution.
Historian Robin R.G. Kelly remarked that finding Derek Chauvin guilty and locking him up in a cage for life is not really satisfactory. This would not deter police misconduct. Talk about the roots of police misconduct, please, and what needs to be done to stop it.
Well, the roots of police misconduct and police brutality, police violence, white supremacy, they all go hand in hand. And as you and Heidi well know, Michael, they come from slavery, the times of slavery and slave patrols. They come from the time of the labor movement in the early 1900s. They come out of the necessity to defend the property and to defend the powers that be and the powers in a particular jurisdiction or nationally defend the powers of government. And they are, by and large, particularly in communities of color and communities, poor communities, they are a repressive and oppressive force. There is real questions raised by very important scholars and activists on the left, including Kelly and Miriam Kaba and many others, in terms of abolition and in terms of defunding the police and in terms of abolishing the police. And, you know, there's a real issue in the movement and outside of the movement about the efficacy of prosecutions of police officers. And we saw this and dealt with this to some degree 10 years ago, when we were calling for and had been calling for and had been pushing for the prosecution of the main torturer here in Chicago, John Burge. And the question became, particularly after he was convicted by a predominantly white jury, by the way, of obstruction of justice and perjury for lying about police torture, the question was, well, what kind of a sentence should the movement demand? And the survivors of police torture, like the families of the and many of the friends Americans and a good portion of the movements that support the people who either survive or who are killed by police violence, they want a maximum sentence by and large. They want the person to suffer, as the survivors of police torture said here, they want them to suffer the way the survivors did, you know, spend decades in jail, that kind of retribution. But the abolitionist movement, both in terms of prisons and in terms of police, say that's not the solution. That's not where we are going to change fundamentally the society. We need to take the power away from the police. We need to restore power to the community in terms of policing, and ultimately to abolish policing and to take the money that goes to policing and to prisons and use that in a way that it uplifts the communities that are most affected by police violence and by mass incarceration. So I think that's a really important question that Kelly raises and that Miriam Kaba raises in her new best-selling book called We Do This Till We Free Us. And I think that all of us who do this work and have done this work over decades and decades and decades, it really raises a real question that we need to address and to understand, because many people, particularly young people in the movement these days, are raising those kinds of issues.
So, Flynn, in light of what you just said, what are your thoughts about reforming the police by requiring them to wear body cameras, get sensitivity training, live in the communities they patrol, and recruit more black and brown officers?
Well, we as plaintiffs' lawyers in police violence cases have long brought Monell claims. Monell claims dealt with and discovered and evidence of systemic problems within the police department, and suggested that there were remedies that could be taken that the police department was not taking, which made them deliberately indifferent to police violence that was systemic. So the question was front and center to us, or was a question that we were dealing with: does this make any difference? And then the government, particularly under Obama, came in and they took on cases in big cities of systemic police problems, and there were changes made in consent decrees, and they're primarily procedural changes and the kinds of changes that you just mentioned. And I think, without having an actual study or studies in front of me, the answer to your question is the kinds of reforms that often are the ones that the Civil Rights Division does, or to some degree that we affect in our own private litigation, doesn't have as much of an impact on changing police attitudes and changing police conduct as we would hope, because of the fundamental issues that we just talked about. Those kinds of changes, changing the disciplinary system, having more black cops. For example, 5 of the 14 cops who went on the Fred Hampton raid were black. We see that the old adage, we're not white, we're not black, we're blue, in terms of the way the police treat people on the street, is often the case. So there are other reforms that people who I respect deeply, like Mary Howell in New Orleans, have been at the forefront of pioneering, such as peer intervention, teaching peer intervention, and having that come from the superintendent of police on down. And some of those approaches may help to stem the tide of police violence, but the long-term approach has to be, in my view, I'm coming around to the view that the long-term approach has to be towards defunding, abolishing police, and in the interim, the kind of complete community control of police that takes it out of the hands of those who would use it as a tool to oppress rather than a tool to serve and protect.
We're talking to Attorney Flynn Taylor, of the People's Law Office in Chicago. Flint, the Chicago Alliance Against Racist and Political Repression has made big gains in Chicago. Talk about what they've accomplished, please.
Well, among other organizations in the movement for Black Lives across the spectrum here of young people and intergenerational movements that have been fighting against police violence have been proponents of a very broad-based civilian control of the police that has a democratic roots in terms of communities. And that is a proposal that is presently in front of City Council, and it's being debated and fought out. And there is a very strong group of older people that support it. And going beyond that, BYP 100 and Asada's Daughters and other very left organizations in the community have been raising these issues in the streets and also making demands in terms of defunding the police. At this point, our quote-unquote progressive mayor, Lori Lightfoot, who is a former federal prosecutor and really in terms of policing hasn't really changed her stripes as much as she acted like she had when she was running for office, has not embraced the more progressive and radical questions and solutions to police violence in this city.
Offending police officers often use the doctrine of qualified immunity to protect themselves. Where did this doctrine come from? What is it? And how is it used?
Qualified immunity was created pretty much out of whole cloth by the U.S. Supreme Court under Warren Burger back in the early 1980s. They took the defense of the good faith defense and expanded it in a case where Nixon and some of his high-level subordinates were defendants. And in order to give them a blanket kind of immunity, they created something called qualified immunity. And qualified immunity says that if the law was not clearly established at the time that the police officer committed the offense that's in question in a civil rights case, this is now a civil case, not a criminal case. That's a whole different problem when you get to the defenses in criminal cases. But civil cases, that you can apply qualified immunity if that law or that constitutional right was not clearly established. And so then it became a question of whether there was a prior case or cases in the jurisdiction that the offense happened that clearly established and said it was wrong for an officer to do the action that he had taken. Well, at first, that was kind of narrowly applied, but it gave, as time went on, it gave conservative courts particularly, and the Supreme Court more particularly as well, the right to wipe out cases at early stages if the defendant said, oh no, it was not clearly established that it was a constitutional violation at the time that this happened. And so as this doctrine became used and abused in the courts, defendants in civil rights cases, particularly police officers and prison guards and others who commit these atrocities, were hiding behind this doctrine and getting their cases thrown out. And if in North Carolina is a perfect example. They're saying that hogtying, taking a person's feet and a person's handcuffs and attaching them while they're in a prone position, was not a clearly established violation of the Fourth Amendment. In other words, not excessive use of force in a way that was clearly established. And they're very confident and spending hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of thousands of dollars to defend this case so that on summary judgment before trial, they think that the court will throw this case out on the basis that it was not clearly established. This, of course, we're fighting strongly against that, but it has got to a point politically that politicians, progressive politicians, are looking at qualified immunity and saying, we have to ban this. we have to write this out of the law because it is so unfair.
Has there been any progress in reconsidering and rolling back qualified immunity?
Well, we've seen that some judges have spoken out with regard to it, particularly some African-American judges in the Fourth Circuit have written articles about it and written dissents about it. And there's progressive politicians, particularly in the House of Representatives, that have proposed a bill or bills that would ban qualified immunity. I haven't checked recently to see what, if any, progress there's been. I think Representative Presley from Massachusetts has introduced such a bill, but I don't know whether it's come out of committee or not.
Flint, do civil rights lawsuits deter police misconduct? Your law firm, the People's Law Office, has won millions of dollars in lawsuits against the Chicago Police Department. Has it had any effect?
That's another hard question. You all are asking me really important, but I think hard questions to answer. Obviously, we fought very hard for now over five decades in the field of police misconduct and police violence, and we brought out a lot of important evidence over those years. I think that when we look at it, beyond any verdicts or settlements that we've gotten in individual cases, what we've been able to do is attack the systemic nature of police violence, to attack and expose the racial aspects, the white supremacist aspects, the systemic racism aspects of police violence and law enforcement violence. And through our work, similar to, I would say, to the work that Michael Ratner and people at the Center for Constitutional Rights have done over the same period of time, we have been able to aid the movements against police violence in terms of uncovering evidence of torture, uncovering evidence of assassination in the Fred Hampton case, uncovering evidence that the movement can use, that can be used in educating people about the true nature of police violence and the true racist and white supremacist nature of what we're dealing with in the cases that we are litigating. So the ultimate resolution, although important, of course, to those who are affected by the violence and the brutality, is not the only goal and the only victory, as it were, that we can claim. And in terms of having an impact on changing practices of the police department or law enforcement in general, I think as important as the result of an individual case within the confines of the courthouse is that the success that we've had, to the degree we've had it, in terms of uncovering and exposing and educating about those practices. And in that way, sometimes those practices are changed, and at least in some small way we can see the movements of today and the kinds of practices that are being attacked both in the streets and in the legislatures and in city councils, all of that, have at a root some of the work that we have done and continue to do. So in that sense, I think there's a broader answer to the question than just have, I guess the short answer to your question then would be yes, but perhaps not in the way that people traditionally look at the results of litigation, although we've had certainly success in that as well.
Many people, including Angela Davis, believe that incarceration of people in prison is not a solution, that it does no good, not for the imprisoned person, not for the community, certainly not for the victims. They call for prison abolition. Would you agree with prison abolition?
I think as a long-term goal, definitely that should be something that is seriously considered. I have tremendous respect for Angela and for Ruthie Gilmore, who started the abolition movement or was one of the moving forces in the prison abolition movement many years ago. It's hard to argue with what they're saying in terms of the utility of prisons, what prisons do, what mass incarceration is designed to do, the racism and white supremacy that is at bottom in terms of mass incarceration. So ultimately, I think, yes, we need to change society in a way that would facilitate and have an alternative way to deal with offenses rather than to lock people up. You see juveniles being locked up for their entire lives before they're even old enough to really formulate a rational approach to solving problems. We see that so many of the people in prison are in fact victims of society in terms of the education, prison, you know, the school-to-prison pipeline, for example. We see all of the fact of poverty and how that impacts incarceration, and we see the conditions in the prisons themselves, and it certainly is true that prisons don't help an individual by and large when they're locked up. So I think there's numerous significant reasons as to why prisons, if not abolished in the short term, should ultimately be abolished. And in the short term, as many people released from prison and not sent to prison as can be dealt with within the confines of the system that we're presently dealing with.
And Flint, do you think if we envision such a future, there should be exceptions and that some people are so inherently dangerous to society that they should be locked up?
I would hope that ultimately we wouldn't have to have prisons at all, because those kinds of violent offenses that you're raising would not be an issue. And if they were, there would be alternative ways to deal with it. But that is a question that is raised by many serious people within the movement as when abolition is talked about, in terms of some of the more serious crimes that people are incarcerated for. I don't have a simple answer to that, Heidi, I don't think.
Flint, we're coming down to the end of our allotted time here. I had wanted you to reflect upon the Derek Chauvin situation as we conclude. If you were the sole judge and jury of Derek Chauvin, what would you do?
Michael, you ask questions that another radio show host here in Chicago, who the show is called This Is Hell, and his final question is one that he always asks these people he interviews. He says, this is a question that I hate to ask, that you're going to hate to answer, and the audience is going to hate your response. And that this is a question from hell, I have to say. What would I do if I... But part of me says, yeah, throw the book at him, right? It was a terrible offense. It was on videotape. It's symptomatic of police violence that we see across the country in so many different ways. On the other hand, I would understand that putting him in jail isn't going to solve police violence. It isn't going to end white supremacy. And if I had the power to change, then you're going to give me the power to change everything and to change what the community, the resources in the community from which George Floyd and other victims and survivors of police violence come from. We're going to change fundamentally the system that created the police officer that is on trial. If I'm sitting there in that chair, you're going to have to give me enough power as there is to change everything that fundamentally underpins what we're looking at here, not just the evidence that's being presented in court in that one case. Because the evidence in that one case, you don't have to go beyond the videotape to come to the conclusion of what happened. And the question is why it happened and what we're going to do to deal with it beyond the individual who's on trial.
Flint, before we let you go, how can our listeners follow your work and that of your law office, the People's Law Office?
Well, we are in Chicago. You can see our website at peopleslawoffice.com. We have several books we have written. I've written one called The Torture Machine, Racism and Police Violence in Chicago, which Haymarket Books is the publisher. And my partner, Jeff Haas, has written a book on the assassination of Fred Hampton, which is very current at this time. And my partner, Joey Mogul, has also written a book about violence against queer folks. And so those are some of the ways that you can follow us. We also write various articles on Truth Out and other places. So those are some of the ways you can follow us.
Flint, it's, as usual, been a pleasure to talk to you, especially with everything that's going on now. We hope to talk to you again soon.
Yes, and I appreciate you having me on, and it's always a very important radio show to contribute to. I also want to give a shout-out to your departed host, Michael Ratner, and he was such a great people's lawyer, and we miss him very much.
Flint Taylor, thank you so much for being on Law and Disorder, and good luck with your work.
Thank you, Michael. Thank you, Heidi.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org. That's lawanddisorder.org.